Welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. This series features short stories drawn from the pages and past issues of the magazine. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of AHMM. This time out, we are featuring Stephen Ross reading his story, Boundary Bridge, which recounts the travails of an American screenwriter living in New Zealand. In 2011, Mr. Ross traveled from his native New Zealand to New York because his story, Monsieur Alice is Absent, was a finalist for an Edgar Award. And now Stephen Ross reads Boundary Bridge.
Waikato River flowed through Hamilton like a dark freeway. I spent afternoons sitting at the table in the living room, staring down at its cool, shady water. Any day, damn it, I was going to jump in and hitch a ride out of town. It was summer. I was staying in a small bungalow on the edge of the city, and the weather was killing me. It was hot and humid and no better in the shade. The atmosphere was suffocating and damp. It was like being slow-cooked in an oven bag with a hunk of beef and a dozen potatoes. The weather was in Celsius, which was a language I didn't speak. Hamilton was in New Zealand, several thousand miles in the Pacific Ocean away from the dry air of El Segundo, near LAX, which was my ever-loving home. Waikato was a Maori word. It meant flowing water. River was an English word. It also meant flowing water. Go figure. The buzzer on the front door chirped. I'd been expecting it. I'd put in a phone call to the local police. I'd seen someone jump into that flowing water, and I thought they should know about it. "Would you mind not smoking?" Detective Shannon asked. He was in his 30s, smart suit, stocky frame, hair shaved down to a shadow. His tone suggested there wasn't a question mark at the end of that sentence. I stubbed out my cigarette. Detective Shannon was seated on the purple sofa. He had nowhere to go in a hurry. He was leaning back, an ankle resting on a knee, and slowly rotating a black mobile phone about in the grip of his left hand. "What did you see?" he asked. "I saw a kid jump into the river." "Where did he jump into the river?" I pointed out the window. "He jumped from the bridge." Shannon leaned to one side. He looked past me. A large wide window afforded the living room a view of the river. There was a bridge over it, about 100 yards downstream. "The Boundary Road Bridge?" he asked. I nodded. "I was sitting here at the table," I explained, "like I am now, and something caught my eye. I looked over to the bridge, and I saw a kid jump. He hit the water head first." Shannon sat back. He noted the computer laptop on the table in front of me. Next to it was a Kiwi English dictionary and a copy of the New Zealand Police Manual. He recognized the manual. Well, he would. "I'm a television writer," I explained. "I'm writing episodes for Humphrey Kemp." Shannon nodded. He knew the show. Well, he would. Humphrey Kemp was a local made police procedural that had been on air for a decade. "How long have you been in New Zealand?" he asked. 3 months. He noticed the band-aid on my thumb. I hit it with a hammer. "You're American?" "Yeah." "Did the kid die?" "He was a university student. His student ID and a library card are all we have to work with at this moment." "Did he die?" "We've only just taken his body out of the water. He was found 2 kilometers downstream." "Did he die?" I was taking a dislike to this fellow. "His neck was broken." I frowned a forehead of creases. "Why do you think he killed himself?" "Did you see anyone else on the bridge?" "I only saw the kid. He jumped." There was nothing distinguishing about the boundary bridge. It was a high, flat, narrow band of concrete held aloft by three slim support columns. It wasn't even the only bridge over the river. It was possible an architect or an engineer would find something of merit in the thing, but I wouldn't lay money on it. The kid hadn't jumped. I'd pushed him. I'd started going for afternoon walks. I was not in my prime anymore. My doctor back in California had recommended I get outside each day and get some exercise. He had also recommended my quitting smoking. Walking afforded a good opportunity to think about what I was writing and to work through any story problems on a purely mental level. No paper or pens to distract me. No phone. No computer cursor blinking with expectation. Every other day, I'd walk along Boundary Road and cross over the river. I'd follow the road for a couple of miles and then I'd buy a packet of cigarettes from a convenience store. They called these dairies here, so named because they used to be the only place you could buy milk. Go figure. Earlier in the day, I might walk back from the dairy. I'd followed a scruffy kid with his hair tied into pigtails. He'd probably been walking into the city to buy drugs or to start a fight. He'd been wearing a black t-shirt, baggy black shorts and red high-top sneakers. On his head had sat a pair of fat black headphones that looked like they'd fallen out of the 1970s. He'd been listening to something that had sounded like a wood chipper grinding its way through a bucket of nails. I overtook him with brisk steps. The sidewalk was narrow, and he was hogging the middle of it. Our shoulders had brushed. I glanced at him. He looked at me. It was a face of contempt, unshaven and crooked teeth. He said, "Fuck you." You could see my bungalow from up there on the boundary bridge. The bungalow had been built in the 1950s. It had a stucco exterior painted in navy blue and a tin roof painted in rust red. It sat up on the riverbank surrounded by trees and a scattering of houses. It belonged to the man who was producing Humphrey Kemp. He had suggested I live in it while working. According to him, pleasant fellow, it was a quiet spot and the currents of the river could be meditative. Was homely enough, I guess. 2 days ago, I found a hammer in the closet and I hung up a picture of my daughter. I hurt my thumb putting in the nail. I'd phoned the police after I'd returned to the bungalow. I wanted to immediately frame the bridge incident as a suicide. As it happened, I hadn't needed an alibi, but by phoning the police and reporting what I'd seen, I'd certainly created one. And anyhow, for my research purposes, having a walking, talking example of local law enforcement come and sit on the purple sofa was an irresistible opportunity. I wrote at Columbo once. I had writing credits on shows as diverse as Ironside, Hawaii 5-0, Room 222, McLeod and the Mod Squad. I had credits for nearly 2 dozen movies of the week, and I'd been nominated for an Emmy. In 1979, I punched a director. I'd been hired to write The Pilot for Madeline, a show about a retired beatician who solved murders using tea leaves and tarot cards. An elderly and respected actress had signed for the lead. I met with her at her home in Brentwood to discuss her character arc. In an expletive-filled gust of cigarette and whiskey fumes, she informed me she had taken the part solely to finance the extension of her patio, and she didn't give a blind rat's ass what her character did. I could arc de triomphe for all she cared. The next day, the show's director and I argued over Madeline's sidekick, a cat that could read minds and spoke with the voice of Jim Backus. I took out one of the director's front teeth. I still have a copy of my mugshot. The pilot was shot, and to this day the footage rots in a vault somewhere in Burbank. In late 1980, I returned to writing short stories, and I started on a book. You do things like that when your phone is turned to stone. It was a lean time, a mayonnaise on bread and a coffee without milk kind of time. And then in 1984, my wife and daughter left me, and I moved into a one-room in El Segundo near LAX. My daughter's parting words were, "When are you going to get a real job, Daddy?" For the rest of the 20th century, I carved out a pay-the-bills career as a crime writer. I wrote my Thackeray mysteries. I had two screenplays optioned by a British production company, and I had a short story make the shortlist for an Edgar. And then my publisher dropped me. In all, I wrote 19 books featuring Will Thackeray, a down-at-heel PI who lived in El Segundo, near LAX, with a dog named Dobbin. Thackeray was me, a bespectacled old man, out of time and out of place, grumpily flicking cigarettes off the end of the pier at Manhattan Beach. The only difference between us was that he did something useful with his time, and my dog, Sedley, left after a month and moved in with the neighbours. I loved my daughter. She phoned every month. She grew up to be a smart, attractive kid. She's now a business analyst and lives down in San Diego with her husband. She's the only thing I really care about in this world. The next morning I put on my sunglasses and hat and I walked into the city. My street was right on the edge of town, so in 4 minutes I was on Victoria Street, the main street in Hamilton. I located a suitable public trash can and I dumped into it a wad of global warming pamphlets. Is there global warming? Hell, I don't know. But I refused to have blind acceptance of it shoved down my throat like I didn't know any better. Least of all by a young man sporting blonde dreadlocks and the insufferable belief that being young made him right. I visited the bank and I retrieved some money. I went to a supermarket and I bought bananas, apples, 8 cans of air freshener, 12 packets of latex cleaning gloves, a packet of cookies, and a copy of Time magazine, Pacific Edition. I found a hardware store and I bought a handsaw and 2 dozen replacement blades, together with an 8-inch pair of shears, the kind dressmakers use for cutting cloth. You can't shred clothing with ordinary scissors. It takes forever and gives you blisters. A noonday copy of the Waikato Times was waiting for me at the bungalow in the mailbox. There was a story on the front page about the kid. His name had been Duncan. Duncan had been in his second year of an information technology degree. Hamilton was a university town. In his spare time, Duncan had been a budding bass guitarist in a band and a vegan, which I think meant he had only eaten bark. I assumed a degree in information technology meant he had been studying computers. I hated computers. I owned a laptop and I would concede it was convenient as a writing tool, but that was as far as I would go. I didn't own a mobile phone. I didn't have a fax machine. I didn't own an email address. And I'd been onto the internet the sum total of 4 times in my life. According to the internet, I'd been born in Akron and I was 98. For the record, I was born in La Honda. I've never set foot in Ohio. And I was 68. Yes, I'd pushed him. I'd shoved him back against the railing. I'd shoved him hard and with enough momentum to topple him right over the edge of it. I'd killed between heartbeats. I had indeed seen him fall from the bridge. I had stared down at him as he plunged headfirst into the river. I had nearly followed after him. My life had ended even before he'd hit the water. In my head, I heard screams and angry voices. I heard cars and trucks stopping. I'd heard people running in my direction. I'd felt the aggression and hatred of an angry mob descending down upon me like a hurricane. I hadn't committed murder behind a closed door and in private, where no one could possibly have seen what I had done, but out on a public road in the bright light of the afternoon sun. And then I had realized I was alone. It had been a peculiar twist of fate. There had been no one else on the sidewalk in either direction. There had been no cars or trucks, not even a bicycle. The kid and I had been the only ones on the bridge. I had murdered someone in the plain sight of everyone. Only there had been no one there for the looking. Detective Shannon was back on the purple sofa. He was back in that casual slouch of his and again twirling his black mobile phone around in his fingers. "We can't find Duncan's phone," he said. The kid had been holding a mobile phone when I'd pushed him, and he dropped it onto the sidewalk. It had been the only part of him that hadn't gone into the river. Stupidly, I'd picked it up and taken it with me. In crime stories, all bad guys have a problem. They leave a clue or say something to contradict themselves. Worse still, they're observed by a casual passerby who's in possession of an accurate timepiece and a conceivable reason to note the time. The problem is the villain's downfall, and the kid's mobile phone was going to be my big bad downfall. The police manual sitting on the table next to my laptop had proudly informed me that New Zealand had been the first country in the British Empire to convict someone solely on the evidence of fingerprints. That had been in 1920. I wasn't dealing with the Keystone Cops down here. It would have been illogical for the kid to kill himself by jumping and to have arbitrarily left something behind. Why not the headphones he had been wearing, or the satchel he had slung over his shoulder? No, the phone looked like it had been dropped. Because it had been. Because he had been pushed. I couldn't have thrown the thing in the river after him. Picking it up had put my fingerprints all over it, and even on the bottom of a river, and factoring in a week before it was located and retrieved, who could say how long my prints and DNA would have stayed on it? Frankly, I hated the minutiae of microbes. I hated stories that relied on microscopes and goatee-chinned lab coats babbling on about forensic baloney I didn't understand. "We can't find Duncan's phone," Detective Shannon said. "Is it important?" I asked. "According to his friends, he always had it with him. Well, maybe he lost it." Shannon rubbed the edge of his black mobile phone along the edge of his stubbly chin. "Duncan had arranged to meet his girlfriend," Shannon explained. "He was going to meet her at the city library. She was finishing work for the day, and they were going to the cinema." "Maybe his phone is on the bottom of the riverbed," I helpfully suggested. Shannon shook his head. Detective Shannon was the most laid-back cop I'd ever encountered. It was like we were lounging by the pool and he was investigating the absence of a cufflink. "How do you know it's not at the bottom of the river?" I asked. Shannon tapped a bunch of buttons on his black phone. He held it to his ear for a moment and then held it out to me to observe. A little view screen on the phone was illuminated. It meant nothing to me. "I just dialed Duncan's phone number," Shannon explained. "His phone is ringing right now." I shrugged my shoulders. "It means his phone isn't underwater." "Okay, where is it?" Shannon turned off his phone. "We're exploring the possibility there was someone else on the bridge." "You think he was mugged?" I asked, helpfully inserting a storyline. "You think another kid stole his phone and then threw him into the river?" "Duncan had bruising to his abdomen. It's consistent with his having been shoved against the bridge's guardrail." I picked up the New Zealand police manual and nonchalantly thumbed through it. It was a dry tome with the thickness of the LA phone book. They had a lot of procedure in this country. "Tell me more about what you were doing when you saw Duncan fall," Shannon asked. "I'm a writer. I was writing." We spent the next 10 minutes cat-mousing each other about what I'd seen. I'd seen the kid fall. I hadn't seen anyone else on the bridge. It was all the absolute truth. I would have probably even passed a lie detector test on it, although the manual said they didn't use those here. Last night I dreamt of Rod Serling. He smoked a cigarette and explained to me that it was a man's destiny to be hoist with his own petard. The fact he told me this in Esperanto and wore an Afro-wig and eyeliner was the tip-off to it being a dream. I'd written A Twilight Zone back in December of 59. I'd received a letter back from Mr. Serling. He had been encouraging and supportive. It had been my first rejection, and it now lived in a frame above my desk in California. I was truly in the zone now. I'd spent the morning chain-smoking at the laptop, watching a team of police divers hoover the riverbed. They brought up rocks and stones, car fenders, empty wine bottles, and the remnants of what looked like dinosaur bones. It was going to be another hot damn day in Hamilton. I went to work with the cans of air freshener. The air was getting a bit whiffy, as they say. Aircon was not a typical household fixture in this country, and the bungalow was a typical household. There was an electric fan in the living room, but all that did was successfully move the warm, damp air from one side of the room over to the other. There was also a dehumidifier. It stood in the corner on wheels and sucked moisture out of the atmosphere. I could have used the machine to run my bath at night. I was emptying its 2-gallon bucket on a regular shift. There was honestly more liquid in the air in the bungalow than there was out in the river. The phone rang. It was a woman from the bank. She wanted to know if I had an MP3 player or something in my safe custody packet in their bank vault, because my packet kept vibrating at odd intervals, and she was sure she could hear Jimi Hendrix's Voodoo Child. 30 minutes later, I was back on Victoria Street and back inside the bank, the magnificently air-conditioned bank. I had no idea what an MP3 player was. A modern version of a Walkman, I figured. I'd never owned one of those either. I stood alone at the end of the counter and went through the contents of my safe custody packet. Passport, $4,000 in US and local currency, local work visas and employment contract, and the kid's mobile phone. There was a message on the phone's little view screen. 37 missed calls. What was I going to do with this damn thing? I buried the phone in the bottom of my pocket and resealed the packet. The woman banker then went and put the packet back into the depths of the bank vault. She wished me a nice day. I went to the supermarket and I bought a carton of plastic bags and another dozen cans of air freshener. I arrived back at my street and remembered I was out of cigarettes. I remembered the dairy. I procured my smoking supplies from a dairy on the other side of the river. It was the point of my afternoon walk. Yesterday, as per routine, I had bought a pack of cigarettes at said dairy, about 30 minutes before I'd sent the kid into the river. I didn't exactly blend into the local shrubbery. I stood out like a thumb slammed with a hammer. I was American, bald, with a gravel voice and a penchant for Hawaiian shirts. Had the police not made inquiries? Had the Kiwi bloke behind the counter not remembered I'd been in his dairy yesterday afternoon and had bought a deck of American blend cigarettes? Jimi Hendrix launched into a guitar solo in my pocket. Missed call number 38. I went back inside the bungalow and studied the kid's phone. I had no idea how to turn it off. God forbid I should try and accidentally put in a call to his grandmother. When would the batteries go dead? And after that, then what? Smash the phone up into little bits and eat it? I went to work again with a can of air freshener. I was leaving a long trail of dots. If anybody ever connected them all together, they'd see my smiling mugshot staring back at them. I stripped down of my underwear and I sat back at the laptop. The police manual reported the death penalty was no longer on the books in this country. They had last hung someone in 1957. Lucky me. Just after midnight, I typed Fade Out, and I saved episode 188 of Humphrey Kemp to a floppy disk. Detective Kemp had once again cracked the case, and the bad guy had gone to jail. The clues had been a fingerprint on a golf club, a contradictory remark about a hood ornament, and a parson with a portable sundial. It was 2 degrees cooler at night. It was the only time of the day I could comfortably strike the keys. I sat there, sans cigarette, and pondered the logic of episode 188. Television is consumed fast, like a bag of Cheetos in a room full of preschoolers. The logic of a plot has to be impeccable. There can be no loose ends, and everything has to make sense. There can be no leftovers in the story bag. I glanced at the kid's mobile phone. There were now 57 missed calls. It occurred to me that logic was only required in fiction. You know, suspension of belief requires a degree of logical believability. But out here in the real world, Bubba, anything was fair game. Wearing gloves, I rigorously cleaned the kid's mobile phone. I spent 2 hours polishing that little hunk of plastic until I could be sure every ounce of humanity had been scraped off. I then placed the phone into a plastic bag, and along with the phone, I tossed in 3 neon-colored clothespins and a portrait of Stalin I had snipped out of time. I sealed the plastic bag, took it outside, and threw it into the river. The air in the bag kept the package afloat, and I watched it sail away in the moonlight. The phone would eventually be found. It might even wind up in the hands of the police. It would be asked, why was Duncan's phone in a plastic bag with a handful of clothespins and Joseph Stalin? Why were there no fingerprints on any of it? By the same token, it could also be asked why Duncan had worn his hair in pigtails, or why he had had metal stuck through his eyebrow, his nose, and the corner of his mouth, or why the satchel he had been carrying was radioactive green in color and emblazoned with the word cogitate. No logical conclusion would be found. And where there is no logic, there is doubt. And in doubt is my safety. And in the end, stroking the stubble on their detective heads, they'd boil it down to this. Kids, go figure. The next day, I laid low in the bungalow. I spent the afternoon proofreading episode 188 and emptying the dehumidifier. If the dots remained unconnected, I wasn't going to jail. No one had seen me push the kid, and maybe he had gotten his bruises someplace else. You know what kids are like, always getting into trouble. There was no evidence I had sent him into the river. And not the suggestion I had, and why on earth would I have done? apart from the one incident back in 79, I had a clean police record. Hell, I was a model citizen. I was an elderly gentleman, a professional rider. I didn't drink and I didn't jaywalk. I even gave regularly to charity, animal services. So long as I didn't lose my cool in this unendurable weather, then I would be, metaphorically, in the getaway car with a full tank of gas. Or more appropriately, in the speedboat heading downriver for the open sea. Self-control. I was going to have to work on that. I was a man ordinarily in complete control, who for a naked moment had gotten out of control and had lost it in public. There was no excuse. I was not going to lose my self-control in public again. Not ever. No way. I sprayed more air freshener throughout the house. I had to quit fretting about the kid in the river. I had things to do. I had to start on the first draft of the next episode of Humphrey Kemp, and I had to deal with the kid in the bathtub, the blonde dreadlocks. If you're going to come and bang on someone's door so loud it scares the holy crap out of him, and he misses his aim with a hammer, don't then get your foot in his doorway and start an argument about saving the planet, leastways when he's still holding the damn hammer. And I also had to deal with Detective Shannon. He was in the tub along with the blonde dreadlocks. The police manual had hit his head like a Louisville slugger. I hadn't liked the way it looked at me. There'd been a pejorative connotation. And only God knew what I was going to do with his mobile phone.
That was Stephen Ross reading Boundary Bridge, which appeared in the March 2010 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Mr. Ross also wrote and performed the music you just heard in this podcast. Thanks to Jackie Sherbo and Emily Hockaday for their production assistance. AHMM is available for subscription in both print and electronic formats. For more information, please go to our website at www.themysteryplace.com or look for us on Facebook. Thank you for listening.